Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Framed ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
Both sides ready?
Yes, Judge.
Yes.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have been sworn as jurors to try this case. At this time, the attorneys will have an opportunity to make their opening statements. I ask, ladies and gentlemen, that you please give the lawyers your close attention.
December 20th of 2002 is a date that is burned collectively into the memory of the Johnsburg community. Brian Carrick was 17 years old, a student at Johnsburg High School. On December 20th, 2002, he disappeared from the face of the earth. To this day, his body has never been found. All that remains of Brian Carrick on this earth is droplets of his blood that were left behind inside and outside of a cooler, a produce cooler at Val's grocery store where he worked.
I certainly agree that you'll find that what happened in Johnsburg, whatever it was a major thing and something that changed the lives of a lot of people. For years and years and years, the police and the state's attorney's office were under great pressure to bring someone to justice for this case. The problem is when you look at all of these witnesses, the conclusion is, I don't know. We don't know what happened. We have no idea.
This is Framed. I am your host, Aaron. It was a normal Friday night in Johnsburg, Illinois. Christmas was just around the corner, less than a week away. The days were getting shorter, the nights colder. While most were dreading the long winter ahead, Brian Carrick welcomed the change in season. The falling temperatures meant he would soon be celebrating his favorite holiday around the Christmas tree with his family. He had other reasons to be cheerful. That Friday was the last day of school before a well-deserved two-week break. Brian viewed the break from school as an opportunity to pick up some extra hours at work, but to Brian, it wasn't all about the money. He truly loved his job working at Val's Foods. He was officially listed as a stock boy, but he was so much more than that. He worked as a cashier. He worked in the deli. The meat department. Every job that could be done in that store, he did it. His work ethic was unparalleled, and his efforts did not go unnoticed. When Brian stopped by that night to pick up his paycheck, there was an envelope waiting for him with a cash bonus inside. Brian used some of that money to buy a frozen pizza and some soda before returning home. Later that night, something drew Brian back to the grocery store. Several co-workers saw Brian walk into the store. No one saw him leave. Brian's mother, Terry Carrick, grew concerned when she realized Brian hadn't come home the night before. Terry would later share that
Brian wasn't one to go out a lot. He was either here or at work. We assumed he had gone to somebody's house and didn't call, you know.
Brian's older brother, Eddie, also worked as a stock boy at the grocery store. When Eddie noticed Brian hadn't shown up for his shift the following afternoon, he was shocked. Knowing that was very unlike his younger brother, he informed his mother. Terry promptly reported Brian missing. She told the police,
Brian never missed work. Mm-mm. If he was late, he'd call. If they called him to come in on his day off, he was out the door.
Whatever fate befell Brian Carrick that night was a tragic one. The mystery of what happened to Brian has been pondered by many. Over time, two theories have divided the Johnsburg community. Supporters from each side can picture in their minds how Brian's final moments played out. Both sides truly believe they know who killed Brian. Both sides have facts. Which picture comes into focus just depends on how those facts are framed. This season on Framed, we are going to examine the case of Brian Carrick. One thing that makes this cold case unique is that it has been in and out of court for over a decade. multiple court filings equate to more documents and information available to the public. What those documents ultimately reveal is a suspect list of two. The only two people who ever faced charges in this case, Mario Cachero and Rob Render. Both Mario and Rob were employed as stock boys at Vail's Foods in 2002, and both were working at Vail's on the very night Brian disappeared. Rob Render was charged with concealing Brian's homicide in 2008, but those charges were eventually dropped. Rob later died of a drug overdose in 2012. In 2013, Mario was found guilty of the murder of Brian Carrick. 2 years later, that guilty verdict was overturned by an appellate court. Mario was set free. He will never again face charges related to this case. The justice system failed to provide closure for Brian's family and friends, but there is still something that can be done. There is a definition of justice that I think applies here, and it is, justice is truth in action. If there is some measure of justice we can provide on behalf of Brian, it's by telling the truth of what happened to him. This podcast's lofty goal is to find out exactly what happened in the back of that grocery store on a cold December night in 2002. Brian's loved ones, the Johnsburg community, and everyone who has been affected by this case deserve better than those theories. They deserve the truth. What you heard in the opening sequence was a recreation of court proceedings that took place at Mario's murder trial in 2013. These recreations are something we are going to be doing a lot of. As you listen to these snippets from trial, you will hear what those 12 jurors who convicted Mario Cachero of murder heard. Beyond that, you will be privy to several facts that jurors weren't allowed to hear. Some of these facts were overlooked, while others were deemed inadmissible by the judge. Thankfully, we aren't held to the same evidentiary rules as the courts. We are going to put all of the relevant pieces of this puzzle on the table, regardless of which side it helps. I encourage you to attempt to connect the pieces as we go along. Although I will warn you now, it's not going to be an easy task. This trial started 10 years after the murder occurred. You'll hear from people who are trying to tell the truth to the best of their recollection, but whose memories are admittedly a little fuzzy. There are going to be inconsistencies and contradictions between various witnesses' statements that will take some sorting out. Mario's attorney, Brian Tallender, was unable to make sense of this complicated fact pattern. He expressed the following during his closing statement.
Every witness says something that contradicts another witness. Now, I'm not going to say they're lying. People are just, well, that's what's most frustrating. People are saying things that they don't know are true.
The state argued during their closing statements that
we don't need to prove the exact cause, the exact time, the exact place of Brian Carrick's death. We don't need to prove how Mario got rid of Brian Carrick's body or where he may have disposed of him.
So when it came to the specifics of how the crime occurred, both sides could offer nothing more than a shrug of the shoulders, and I think this is why so many people are frustrated by this case. People wonder how a 17-year-old kid could walk into a grocery store where he worked for years, a place where he knew everybody, and nobody saw anything that could explain what happened. When I first became aware of this case and started reading up on it, I was just as baffled as everyone else. As I got deeper into the case file, I realized my assumption that nobody saw anything that could help solve this mystery wasn't exactly true. Of the 14 employees on duty at Vail's when Brian arrived at the store for the final time, 9 of them remembered seeing Brian in the store. Some of those employees even spoke with Brian. All of these interactions likely occurred during the last 10 minutes of Brian's life. Their stories, when told individually, aren't sensational. Individually, they aren't newsworthy, but collectively, they tell the story of Brian Carrick's final moments. Over the course of this series, we're going to go over their stories one by one, witness by witness. In a jury trial like the one that happened in 2013, jurors see witnesses file in one after another. They are bombarded with all sorts of information. After all the evidence has been presented, the jurors retire to deliberate to try to make sense of everything that's been thrown at them. Our format is going to be a little different. Rather than waiting until the end, we are going to pause to analyze the facts as they are presented. This will allow us to reach an educated conclusion by season's end. In 2010, a detective on this case told one of our suspects,
All along, I've just been waiting for you to be the glue that holds the puzzle together, because we got all the pieces.
Over the past several years, we at Framed have gathered all those pieces. We're going to solve this puzzle. As we start to truly dive into this case, let's start at the beginning and learn a little more about the Carrick family dynamic, and why they were so admired and respected within the Johnsburg community. Brian Carrick was the 11th of 14 Carrick children. Brian's sister told reporters,
"I'm not sure my parents had planned to have such a large family, but they enjoyed having a house full of children. The kids just started coming and never stopped. My mom was a good Irish Catholic. I guess that explains it. It was fun and chaotic."
A house rule at the Carrick homestead was if you were home for dinner, you had to eat at the table. And if you got in trouble at dinner,
you were the one doing the dishes.
The family patriarch was William Carrick, better known to his friends as Bill. He worked as an electrician. He was very proud of all of his children, and between work and various side jobs, he always made an effort to spend some quality time with each child individually. Terry Carrick was his loving wife. She was primarily a stay-at-home mother, but also worked some part-time jobs here and there to help make ends meet when needed. She was described as a loyal friend and was actively involved in the community despite having a full plate at home. Bill served as the family spokesperson throughout Mario's trial. It's unlikely that he would have taken on that role if his wife Terry was still alive when the trial began. Terry passed away on November 21, 2009, after a fight with leukemia and lung cancer. Prior to her passing, Terry was very outspoken in the media about her son's disappearance. She never let the case slip out of the public eye in the hopes that increased attention would one day bring the truth to light.
Brian's disappearance was her primary focus until she passed away.
The unknown was probably the worst part. It was catastrophic and all-consuming for my mother. She never had closure on Brian.
A few years later, on December 30th, 2014, Bill Carrick passed away from natural causes. After Bill Carrick's death, one of his daughters described how Brian's disappearance affected her father.
The whole situation left him really upset to the point where I don't think he ever quite got over it. I don't think he accepted or moved on from it. I think he was sort of always dealing with it.
Bill and Terry expressed that although they wanted answers, they realized they would never have closure.
Losing a child leaves a hole in your heart that will never close.
Towards the end, they found comfort in helping other grieving parents who had also lost children. Their message to parents going through similar situations was that while the pain will always be there, each day gets a little easier. Both Bill and Terry yearned to learn the truth of what happened to Brian. Certainly, they wanted justice for their son, and they wanted to see the person or persons responsible for his death held accountable for their actions. The beauty of the Carricks is they weren't driven by anger or hate. What they wanted above all else was an opportunity to look their son's murderer in the eyes and forgive him.
State, please call your first witness.
Mr. Carrick, please. Please state your name, sir.
My name is William Carrick.
And Mr. Carrick, do you live in Johnsburg?
Yes, I do.
And how many children do you have?
13.
Are you a widow, sir?
I am.
Okay. And your wife's name?
Terry.
Okay. I'm going to show you what I've marked as People's Exhibit A. Do you recognize who is in this picture, sir?
Yes, I do.
And who is that?
That's my son, Brian.
And since December 20th of 2002, have you seen your son, Brian?
No, I haven't.
And do you recall approximately what time that day was the last time you saw him?
Oh, I think it was around 5:30, somewhere in there.
Now, the family home, the Carrick home, was that in close proximity to Val's grocery store?
And we were directly across the street.
And how would Brian get to work?
Well, he would just walk across the street.
No further questions.
Mr. Thielander, any questions?
Some of your other children work there too, correct?
I think almost all of them did.
You've had a long history with the Cachero family that owned the place.
That's correct.
That's all. Thank you.
Framed is sponsored by HelloFresh. Is a meal kit delivery service that shops, plans, and delivers step-by-step recipes and pre-measured ingredients so you can just cook, eat, and enjoy. With three plans to choose from, Classic, Veggie, and Family, each box is made up of fresh, responsibly obtained ingredients from carefully selected farms and high-rated trusted sources. These simple recipes are outlined on pictured step-by-step instruction cards that are very easy to follow. And better yet, HelloFresh is delivered right to your door in recyclable, insulated packaging. HelloFresh goes beyond just providing a healthy meal. They also provide many one-pot recipes for seriously speedy cooking and minimal cleanup. Once you realize how tasty and convenient HelloFresh is, you'll spend less time meal planning and grocery shopping, which will get you out of your recipe rut, and you'll start cooking outside of your comfort zone with delicious recipes, filling meals, delivered right to your door every week for less than $10 per serving and free shipping. I have used HelloFresh a number of times in the past, and I love that each week you get a new recipe. It's something new to try. It's healthy. All the ingredients are top quality. One of my favorite recipes, Korean chicken tacos. It's a mix of Korean and Mexican cuisines, tacos filled with chicken and cabbage. In my house, tacos are always a hit. For a total of $60 off, that's $20 off your first three boxes, visit HelloFresh.com/framed60 and enter code framed60. Again, for a total of $60 off, that's $20 off your first three boxes, visit HelloFresh.com/framed60 and enter code framed60. That's FRAMED60.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
In 1991, Sal DiMarco immigrated to the United States from Italy. He came to the village of Johnsburg, Illinois. It was a small community, consisting of a little over 4,500 people, but it was growing. Sal was determined to live out the American dream. He partnered with his brother and opened a grocery store. He named it after his daughter, Val. Val's foods would soon become a staple in the community. Mario Cachero's father, Jerry Cachero, was also an owner and manager of Val's Foods. Like the Carrick family, the Cacheros were well known throughout the Johnsburg community. Over time, the Cacheros and the Carricks developed a symbiotic relationship of sorts. In a household with 14 children, you don't have the resources to give all of your teenagers cars. So if you were a Carrick kid, your only options were to walk to work or not work at all. Vale's was a large employer, and it was directly across the street from their house. Naturally, nearly all of the Carrick kids ended up working there at one point or another. Vale's benefited from having a steady stream of hard-working, reliable kids who lived close. If you were a Carrick, you'd need only fill in the last name on the Vale's job application, and you would be hired on the spot. Everything changed after Brian disappeared. Word quickly spread around town that Mario was a suspect in Brian's disappearance and presumed murder. The relationship between the Carricks and the Cacheros deteriorated rapidly. The people of Johnsburg stopped shopping at Vale's Foods. Vale's would eventually close its doors for good in 2010, 1 year shy of Sal's 20th anniversary of immigrating to America. Sal cited Brian's murder as the turning point in the business's otherwise successful run. Before we get too deep into the case file, I want to take a moment to give you a brief description of Vale's Foods as it was in 2002. As witnesses describe where they were in the store that night and what they saw, it will be important to have a good understanding of Vale's floor plan. If you would like to see it, head over to framedpod.com to see the floor plan for yourself. From a customer's perspective, the layout was pretty simple. The store took the shape of a square which was approximately 50 yards wide and 50 yards deep. There was one entrance located at the center of Vale's storefront. Directly through the front doors were the checkout lanes and a few rows of shopping carts. Customers were encouraged to circle the store in a counterclockwise direction after grabbing a cart. The produce section was the first stop. It was situated in the front right corner of the store. As customers continued around Val's, they would pass the deli and bakery, which sat at the right rear corner. Down the back aisle, just past the deli, was the meat department. At the far end of the back aisle, in the left rear corner of the store, there were some swinging double doors which led to the receiving area. The beer, wine, and liquor section was located in the front left corner, next to the checkout lanes by the main entrance. In total, there were 8 aisles that stretched vertically from the cash registers at the front of the store toward the deli and meat departments at the rear of the store. To describe the employee-only areas of the store, let's go back to Sunday, December 22, 2002. 2 Johnsburg police officers arrived at Bell's Foods to investigate Brian's disappearance. Sergeant William Grunes was the lead detective, and Corporal Keith Von Allman was accompanying him.
Are you guys here about Brian?
Yes.
There's something you guys should know. Another stock boy told me there was a fight in the produce cooler Friday night. He told me he was asked to clean up a mess in there by the owner.
Grunes and Von Allman proceeded to the produce area to check for signs of a struggle. Once in the produce section, they saw a doorway with some transparent curtains hanging down, signaling to customers that this was an employee-only area. The detectives walked through the curtains and into what's known as the produce prep room. The room was rather large, 20 feet wide and 17 feet deep, but there wasn't much to it. There was a table to their left with a scale on it. Along the far wall were 2 stainless steel sinks that were used for washing fruits and vegetables. Directly ahead was a large metal door that led into the walk-in produce cooler. The detectives entered the cooler. It was dimly lit. Panels of raw sheet metal covered the walls and ceiling. To their left hung a ceiling-mounted refrigeration unit that kicked out a steady hum. Along the wall to the right was a standalone shelving unit. One of the detectives spotted something concerning on the center leg of that metal shelving unit.
Hey, Keith, what does this look like to you?
It didn't take long for the detectives to realize what they were seeing. Blood. As they investigated further, they found more blood inside the cooler. There was blood on some boxes, and some individual drops of blood on the floor. Directly across from the door they used to enter the cooler was another door of equivalent size. The detectives opened the second cooler door. That led them to a back hallway. Just beyond the cooler doorway, they discovered a spattering of some blood stains on the lower portion of the hallway wall, but that wasn't all they found. Right there on the hallway cooler door handle was what some forensic experts would consider the Holy Grail, a legible fingerprint in blood. Detectives Grunes and Von Allman had seen enough. They knew something bad happened in that cooler. They called in for backup, and the store was soon overrun with uniformed officers taping off the crime scene. The chief of police arrived at the store and put in a call to the Illinois State Police Crime Unit for help processing the scene. Before the crime scene unit arrived, the detectives explored further down the back hallway. At the end of the hallway was an exit door. The detectives found more blood on the exit door and called over additional officers to secure the scene. They taped off everything, including the dumpsters which sat right outside the back door. There was another hallway that ran along the back of the store. At the far end of the hallway was the receiving area. There was a loading dock with 2 large overhead doors. Also in this area was the employee break room, along with men's and women's restrooms. They found nothing of evidentiary value in the receiving area. Before Detectives Grunes and Von Allman left the scene, they spoke to the manager on duty at that time, Jerry Cachero. Grunes asked if he knew anything about the red substance found in the cooler.
On Saturday morning, when I opened the store, Pablo came up to me and asked what had happened in the produce cooler the night before. He thought it looked like a fight had taken place, so I went over there to take a look. When I walked into the cooler, I saw a large puddle of water on the floor that was reddish in color. There were also coins on the floor, 2 quarters, 2 dimes, and a nickel. I then asked a stock boy, Rob Render, if he knew what happened since he worked Friday night. Rob said that he didn't know what happened. I told him to get a mop bucket and clean up the mess.
There was one last detail Jerry provided that was of interest to the detectives.
When Rob was mopping up the water in the cooler, Pablo told me something else. He said that a knife was missing from the produce area.
After discovering the bloody crime scene in the back of Val's Foods, the next logical step in the investigation was to seek out the employees who were working that night. There were 14 of them in total, including one manager, three cashiers, four stock boys, five deli workers, and one employee working in the meat department. The blood found at the crime scene was located in areas of the store that were only frequented by store employees. In fact, the only employees that had any reason to be in the vicinity of the produce cooler at all were the stock boys. That should have, in theory, narrowed the list of potential suspects down to the four stock boys on duty, or at the very least, made them all significant persons of interest. One complicating factor for the detectives was that this tragedy happened on a Friday, and as every employee of Val's knew, Fridays were paydays. They didn't have direct deposit then, so any employee looking to get paid would stop by sometime that night to pick up their check, whether they were working or not. December 20th, 2002 was no exception. Most of the employees showed up at some point that evening, growing the list of potential perpetrators for the detectives. Since we have the advantage of hindsight, we know that Mario and Rob were the only two people ever charged in this case. We are going to cut through the minutiae and focus on them. Mario sat down with detectives on a few occasions during the initial investigation. During one of those interviews, they asked Mario the following questions.
Can you describe what your relationship was like with Brian?
Brian was my right-hand man. He made the place run. He was a good worker.
Who were the other stock boys working that night, besides you?
Brian's brother Eddie was working, Jacob and Rob.
Are you aware of any disputes or disagreements Brian may have had with any of the other stock boys?
I don't think there were any problems between Eddie and Brian, at least not that I'm aware of. Jacob is a good kid. Not sure if he hung out with Brian outside of work.
What about Rob?
Brian definitely didn't like Rob because he was stealing alcohol from the store. He caught Rob selling shots of alcohol at a party. Brian thought Rob stole the booze from Val, so he reported it to me. We were trying to catch Rob in the act so we could get him fired. Also, since Brian's gone missing, I've heard that Rob owed him money.
Why did he owe Brian money?
I don't know. It's just what I heard.
If you're like me and refuse to let go of your skinny jeans, you're a millennial. And if you're a millennial, it's time to add Clarins Multi-Active Cream to your daily routine. Rooted in nature and innovated with science, Clarins has a long legacy of creating industry-first, plant-forward products. Using a skin charger complex made of 2% niacinamide and sea holly bioextract, Clarins Multi-Active Cream has been clinically proven to target the first visible signs of aging by smoothing lines and wrinkles, refining pores, evening tone and texture, and strengthening the skin's moisture barrier. While Multi-Active Cream can't bring back the golden age of boy bands, it can de-stress your skin. Clarins Multi-Active Cream is available online now. Go to clarins.com/truecrime and get Multi-Active Day and Night Cream for 10% off, a free welcome gift, plus free shipping on your first order. That's clarins.com/truecrime with promo code TRUECRIME. clarins.com/truecrime with promo code TRUECRIME.
Mario denied any involvement in Brian's disappearance, and he told the detectives that he had a positive relationship with Brian. Mario said of the four stock boys working at Val's that night, there was only one they needed to be concerned with, and that was Rob Render. If the detectives could substantiate Mario's claims that Brian was actively trying to get Rob fired, and that Rob owed Brian money, that would certainly give Rob a motive for the crime. As the investigation progressed, the state's attention shifted away from Rob as a suspect, and more towards Mario. In 2008, Rob was interviewed by the police. They asked Rob what he thought happened to Brian.
Do you know anybody that would want to hurt Brian?
He was dealing with drugs, because I know he just started dealing drugs and he got mixed up with someone wrong or owed somebody money.
Okay.
Or, you know, somebody robbed him. I don't know. I have no idea, but that would be my assumption. Brian never did anything wrong. He never ever tried to start a fight in school, so I don't know why anybody would try to attack him, but I know he just started selling drugs at this time, and, you know.
What was he selling?
Just pot, as far as I know. But I heard other rumors after he disappeared that the cops found a bunch of cocaine and a bunch of mushrooms in his safe and all this stuff. Don't know if it's true.
Where was Brian getting his pot from?
What I heard is Mario.
Similar to Mario, Rob told the detectives that he had nothing to do with Brian's disappearance. Rob did share with the authorities that Brian was dealing drugs and that Mario was his supplier. If Mario was in fact supplying Brian with drugs to sell, that could have led to a conflict over money, as Rob suggested. The information Mario and Rob provided established two theories for the crime. The theory the state settled on focused squarely on Mario. In 2007, the state felt they had built a strong enough case to present their findings to a grand jury. For those who aren't entirely familiar with what a grand jury is, it's essentially a secret trial before the trial. The grand jury's purpose is to look at the state's case and determine if they have enough evidence to formally charge a suspect with a crime. Mario was called to testify before the grand jury.
Your name is Mario Cachero.
Yes.
You're a drug dealer, aren't you?
No.
Have you ever been a drug dealer?
No.
Did Brian Carrick ever owe you money for any reason?
No.
Has there ever been an individual who owed you money that you had Shane Lamb rough up?
No.
Did you direct Shane Lamb to scare Brian Carrick?
Not at all.
Did you get into an argument with Brian Carrick outside the produce cooler on December 20th of 2002?
No.
Did you tell Brian that he had to give you your money?
No.
Were you present when Shane Lamb started striking Brian Carrick?
No.
Do you know that Shane Lamb was fighting Brian Carrick in order to get you your money?
No.
Where is Brian Carrick's body?
I have no idea.
You're sure of that?
I'm sure.
What you just heard was the state's theory of the crime. They believed Mario was a want-to-be, drug-dealing tough guy who ran a little drug cartel in Johnsburg, Illinois. The state claimed Mario would front Brian and others with weed for them to sell. After his dealers sold their product, they would pay Mario back his cut and keep the rest. If anyone in the drug ring had a problem getting paid, Shane Lamb would be called in to collect the debt. Shane was the enforcer, the muscle of the operation. He was also employed as a stock boy at Bell's at the time of Brian's disappearance. Although he wasn't on duty at Bell's on the night of December 20th, 2002, the state believed he was there. Shane came back to the store at Mario's behest in order to confront Brian about the money that he owed. The state believed Shane found Brian shortly after arriving at the store and began arguing with him about the debt. Shane lost his temper and punched Brian, ending his life in an instant. At least, that's what the state believed happened. The problem with the state's case was they didn't have enough evidence to support a murder charge. Determined to hold someone accountable for Brian's death, they decided the best they could do was to charge Mario with perjury for lying during his testimony before the grand jury. The case went to trial. Before the jury could decide Mario's fate, the judge declared that the evidence presented by the state was so weak she couldn't allow the trial to continue. The perjury charges were tossed. After the defeat, the state's attorneys pursuing the charges told reporters, "We have an idea of what happened to Brian Carrick. It's a matter of proving it." The state's big break in the case came in 2009 when Shane Lamb got caught dealing cocaine. Shane was facing several felony drug charges that carried sentences up to 30 years in prison. Since the state's case against Mario wasn't strong enough to get perjury charges to stick, they knew they needed someone to flip in order to have a chance at a murder conviction. Even though the state believed Shane was the one who attacked Brian and ended his life, they offered him immunity for any charges related to Brian's case and a greatly reduced drug sentence to boot. Instead of a potential 30-year sentence, he would only spend 3 years in prison. Shane took the deal. Armed with the immunity agreement, Shane told the state's attorneys they had been right all along. Shane told them Mario called him back to the store that night in order to talk to Brian about the money. He showed up at the store, got in a heated argument with Brian, and punched him in the head. Brian fell to the ground unconscious. Shane didn't know if Brian was dead or alive. At that point, he left the store, leaving Mario to deal with the aftermath. It wasn't until later that Shane learned Brian had died from the altercation. With Shane in place as the state's star witness, they charged Mario with murder. Some of you may be wondering how the state was able to charge Mario with murder if Shane was the one who admitted to killing Brian. Their reasoning was simple. They believed Mario was just as culpable as Shane was because he set in motion the events which led to Brian's death. The legal justification for charging Mario with murder was slightly more complicated. The state argued that Mario committed a crime when he directed Shane Lamb to collect money from Brian. The crime that was committed was intimidation, and under Illinois law, intimidation is a felony offense. If someone is killed during the commission of a felony, then whoever committed the felony can be charged with murder. That's how they were able to bring forth first-degree murder charges against Mario, even though they claimed he wasn't directly at fault. The state's first attempt at convicting Mario came up short. The jury was split 11-1 in favor of a guilty verdict. A mistrial was declared. The state pressed on, and at the retrial, Mario was found guilty. He was sentenced to 26 years in prison. For some, the guilty verdict provided justice for Brian. Others questioned how Shane's testimony could be believed. Shane was a career criminal who was given a huge incentive to cooperate with authorities. It seems as though he would have said anything to get that deal and get out of prison. A year after Mario was convicted, Shane was arrested again, this time for stealing a safe full of guns and other valuables from one of his friends. He found himself back in the same courtroom where he testified against Mario, opposed by the same prosecutor who offered him the immunity deal in Mario's case. The state was offering Shane another deal in exchange for information that would help recover the stolen weapons. This time, Shane rejected the deal and lashed out at the prosecutor in court.
"You're trying to bully me into taking a deal for something I didn't do!"
Shane would formally recant his testimony that was used to convict Mario. Shane alleged the prosecutors bullied him into taking the immunity deal.
"Prosecutor Combs said that if I testified against Mario, I would only have to serve about 3 years on my drug cases in East Moline Correctional Center, and that I would never be charged with anything related to Brian's death. Prosecutor Combs also told me that if I did not make a deal, he would make a deal with Rob Render and or Mario, and I would be charged with Brian's murder. I want to make it clear that I had nothing to do with attacking Brian. If he is dead, I have no knowledge where his body is located. I also want to make it clear that I have no knowledge suggesting in any way that Mario was involved in attacking Brian or disposing of his body."
The state dismissed Shane's recanted statement. They believe Shane was just upset about the deal he was being offered on the weapons charges, and he was making things difficult for the state's attorneys as payback. Shane pointed out that by recanting his testimony, his immunity deal was negated, and he could now face murder charges. Shane urged people to believe him, stating that he had nothing to gain and everything to lose. He claimed the real reason his story changed was because he wanted to clear his conscience for falsely testifying against Mario. In 2015, after spending several years behind bars, an appellate court unanimously overturned Mario's guilty conviction, stating, "The state's evidence was so unreasonable, improbable, and unsatisfactory that a reasonable doubt exists." After Shane recanted and Mario's guilty verdict was overturned, it felt as though we were no closer to knowing the truth of what happened to Brian than we were back in 2002. We were back to square one, facing the same question. What happened to Brian Carrick? This is the question that has divided the Johnsburg community. One side believes Mario and Shane were jointly responsible for Brian's death. The other side contends Rob Render is the true killer. So what was this Rob theory based on? What evidence did they have against Rob to justify bringing the concealment charges?
Rob, I don't know if you've been told about some of the evidence against you. Your thumbprint was located on a handle of the cooler in blood.
Hold on, but how was the print? Blood was on the cooler door and then I put my thumb in it, or I had blood on my thumb and I put it in there?
Well, as I'm not a lab technician, I don't have access to their reports right here in front of me.
This season on Framed.
Pete, the reason we're following up with you is because we've obtained information from some of your co-workers at Val's. They told us you may have witnessed an argument in the store last Friday. Can you tell us about what you saw that night?
No, I'm saying in the first 15 minutes. What happened in the cooler? How many people know what happened in those first 15 minutes? There's three, okay? I can tell you I know there's three for certain. We've already got one on our side.
Did Robert Render Sr. give you a call on December 28, 2002, about 8 days after this disappearance, and tell you his son ran away?
I would say yes.
He was caught running through some woods. Is that correct?
That's correct.
We were talking about Shane, and then I brought up, I believe what I said was, I know you told Shane to kill Brian Carrick.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Framed ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
I understand that anybody who's paid attention to the media would have to come to the conclusion that I killed my wife.
Hi, my name is Zach Stewart Pontier. I'm one of the filmmakers behind The Jinx, and I'm excited to bring you the official Jinx podcast. We'll be revisiting all 6 episodes of Part 1 and watching along with Part 2 as it airs on Max, starting April 21st.
Bye-bye.
The official Jinx podcast. Listen on Max or wherever you get your podcasts.